Hello and welcome to the Declined Estate Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Declined Estate is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. If at any point would you like to call in and weigh in the conversation, please contact Skype user Declined Estate with a text message, and we'll do our best to get you on the air. If you're interesting, we may keep you on. That's Declined Estate, spelled out one word, with no punctuation. You can find us on the web at our official website, declinefm.com, and there you will find a link to the brand new live chat. And if there's a topic you want to hear discussed on the show, please submit to r/declinedestate@reddit.com.
All right. Should be a very interesting discussion tonight.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, sorry about that, guys. Just one last thing to remind was links to our live stream and archive episodes can be found at both declinefm.com and r/declinedestate@reddit.com. I'm Ronald McPaul, and then I'm going to go around and let everybody else introduce themselves, but I'm broadcasting from the Silicon Valley.
Oh, right. I'm Wrong Opinion. I, as you know, haunt the ANCAP, voluntarism, agorism, and used to haunt the anarchism subreddit. I'm also a poster on freedomainradio.com, which will come in handy for tonight. And I'll just pass it along to the next guy. Pass it to the left.
All right, yeah, world. I'm Eternal. I'm the show host and everything. You know, frequent poster across all the Liberty subreddits and stuff. Looking forward to a good show tonight. You know, pass it on.
I am Toasty Time.
I am Kwashi Orkor.
And I'm Zom.
This is Rado here. Welcome to Declined Estate. We are manning the operation, and you can listen to us at declinefm.com/live.
Yep, and feel free to call into our Skype at any point. We're welcome to take your calls on any topic. I know that we have a bunch of really interesting topics for today. There's a bunch of good stuff posted on the Declined Estate subreddit, which is www.reddit.com/r/declinedestate. As always, you guys can post up your own content there as well for future casts. Kwash, I know you had something you wanted to discuss at the start of this show.
Yes, there was an article I saw this morning on the ANCAP subreddit, and I think it addressed an issue that had came up before. There was a case where firefighters showed up, and because somebody hadn't paid their fee to the firefighting organization, they basically stood by and let the place burn down. And this was all over Reddit for a while, and people were like, oh, it's a terrible thing. See what happens when we privatize, and this is the future world of libertarianism, and you people are terrible. And the response was basically that, well, if there were a real, you know, capitalist situation, you would have private companies who would be filling the role, and maybe insurance companies even would have an interest in making sure that houses didn't burn down. Insurance companies would hire their own fire protection services and call them out if there were a fire, because it's in their interest to protect the assets that they're insuring. Well, the article I saw this morning said that, let me skip through parts of this. It says, it basically talks about a firefighter who works for such an insurance agency. And it says they cover homes. One company, Chubb Personal Insurance, insures coverage for homes typically valued between $400,000 and $3 million, according to the company's catastrophe manager. He said, it's an added layer of protection for our clients. From a business perspective, it's an extremely advantageous business proposition. So for certain policies, they have, you know, they hire firefighters who go out. And, you know, when there's a forest fire coming through, like in Colorado now, they do added things to try to protect the homes above and beyond what the municipal firefighting organization does. The company has 50 engines and about 100 firefighters strategically located in left and western states, the Dakotas and Texas. Crews work closely with incident commanders at the scene. Everything we do is coordinated. So they focus on insured homes that are facing the greatest threat from the wildfire without regard for the home's value. So I think that's an excellent solution. Again, showing how private systems can protect homes and property and even life without necessarily having to rely on the government. And I think we'll be seeing more of these things as, cities, townships, they're going to be stretched for cash. They're going to have to cut back. I know situations like Detroit, where they're cutting back, they're closing fire departments. It's going to become a greater problem. So it's going to be up to people to try to protect their own properties.
If you don't mind me chiming in here at this point, I think that it's really interesting to see, that obviously when there exists, a level of service, a quality of service that the government doesn't provide, when you have, tiers of service and you have that high quality service, we see the same thing obviously in education where there's private schools, even though the government does provide schools. So all the private firefighting is coming into play when the government doesn't provide enough. When people want that added level of quality. And of course that speaks a lot to what the market does, which is the market doesn't provide a one size fits all solution. They don't do blanket solutions. Rather, they tailor the solution to what clients are willing to pay for them. And clearly, if you get the government out of the way, you'll see, very many tiers of solutions offered by the market, whether it's for the very poor or the very rich. Look at like shoes. Shoes, you can go out and buy some like $5 flip-flops or even go to the thrift store and get them for like a buck or something like that. You get cheap shoes. It's not a problem. Or you can spend, $300 on a nice pair of dress shoes if you really wanted to spend that much. And there's stuff, all the way in between. I'm sure you could probably spend even more than that if you wanted to spend that much money on shoes. And, there's no problem with people don't complain about, well, the poor can't get shoes, or how are we going to provide shoes for everybody, or, people need to have shoes. Obviously, you can't walk around without shoes, so this is, it's definitely something that if the government isn't providing the service, it doesn't mean that it won't be provided to the poor. It doesn't mean that it won't be provided. So when you talk about, something like fire protection and fire insurance, it's important to look at the incentives there to provide the service to the greatest number of customers and to tailor it to whoever, really needs it. Because, obviously if there's a clientele not being served, people will probably try to step up and provide some level of service to them.
I think I want to create a petition on that shoe thing. We should the whitehouse.gov petition thing. We should say, we need shoe insurance, government provided shoe insurance for when our shoes wear out and we're not prepared for it.
Yeah, I mean, God forbid, what if people, don't have shoes, they could, get their nasty feet all over, stores or something. We don't have stores enforcing, the policy of, keeping people without shoes out of their stores and stuff. We want to make sure that everybody has shoes and stores don't have to worry about that. That's important.
Yeah, people without shoes, it's negative externalities, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The government slogan, shoes for every feet.
That should be Vermin Supreme's next slogan. Shoes.
I've been reading. I started reading Walter Block's book on privatization of roads, and he brings up the same thing, saying that it's largely a perception and education problem. He says, well, people have come to expect, that the roads are going to be run by the government because that's how they were raised. And he says if people had been raised to think that the telephone and telegraph had been, government systems, then we'd be asking the same thing, and we'd be saddled with a government-run telecommunication system today. But because things ended up that way, here's where we are. So it's the same with fire protection, I think. Once people become acclimated to the idea that this is something that would actually be better handled by private companies, they'll start to warm up to it. But it's an education process.
I agree. Come to think of it, there's been quite a few countries in the in the history of the world that have actually tried to provide shoes for their subjects. It didn't turn out very well.
Do you have one examples? Model of shoe?
Well, what they do is generally they make shoes in different sizes because it's central planning that fails. So there's a surplus of some size and there's a shortage of other sizes. And then people kind of trade under the, you know, in the black market. The common thread here, and we're talking about the Soviet Union and Cuba here, the common thread is that there's always shortages and there's always rationing of this thing. Right? Whatever the product is, it always happens. I wonder why.
Yeah, well, just going back to the, what you know, we were talking about earlier, like with fire protection, and like, say, Detroit, you know, is cutting back on their fire protection. They're also cutting back on their police protection. Same thing. Like, policemen just won't respond to some calls. And I'm assuming it's the same thing with the fire protection. Like, firemen probably won't respond to some calls. They'll only respond to actual fires or something. And I know around here, like, if I call 911... and, you know, I have a problem with, you know, is a medical emergency of various sorts, even if it's not a super emergency or anything, like I see, you know, some sort of chemical problem, you know, it's like a chemical spill or there's something like, even car accidents and stuff. The fire department's there. Fire department responds to everything around here. And, you know, maybe you're not going to get the fire department coming out to things that they've traditionally came out to deal with, and then people will be left hanging like, well, who the heck's going to come out? And the, you know, the state's sitting there going, we can't really help you. We have to send the fire department to fight, you know, actual fires. We don't have enough people to help you out. So, you know, rationing, it's the same thing. And, you know, I really like that in Detroit, the private security is popping up to take the place of the police forces that just don't do anything anymore. That's really quite something.
The police forces are only providing services for, like, what, 8 hours a day now?
Yeah, it was like 911, only 925. Sorry. Uh-huh,
that's good. And I hear they're actually turning out some of the streetlights in some of the poorer neighborhoods because they can't afford to keep the friggin' lights on.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you want to turn on more streetlights if you're not going to have your cops out at night?
That's what.
Doesn't that deter crime?
Yeah.
They can't afford to keep them lit or to replace the ones that burn out. And, you know, and then you get criminals who put lights out so that they can do their criminal behavior. But, yeah, in fact, the city of Highland Park, whatever company it was who was in charge of the lights or providing it as a service, Highland Park, which is like a city inside of Detroit, they like had budget problems. I don't know if they went bankrupt or whatever, but they stopped paying their bills and the company came and like took all the lights and they're like no street lights in Highland Park now.
That's crazy. Yeah, apparently they're up to $5 million in debt on the light bill in Detroit. And you can just like my roommate worked at GM in Detroit for a summer and there's no traffic laws. I mean, you can run red lights. There's no enforcement because they can't afford it. They actually can't afford to make money on enforcing traffic laws because they don't have enough manpower. They're so in debt. That's crazy.
I was there a few weeks ago in like a major intersection in Detroit, right in the downtown area. The lights were completely out, no cops. I mean, it was coming and going about an hour apart, and the lights were still not on, and there was nobody there. You know, now granted, there's not that much traffic down there on the weekend. You know, unless there's some event going on, you know, it's not like a regular big city, but still there's a considerable amount of traffic and, you know, the city, the services are just breaking down.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. I mean, this is like the prime example of what agorism is all about. You know, when the government can't provide what they say they're going to provide, when there's a gap between what's expected and what's actually provided, the market always tries to step in. And, you know, we could see it could be either really good or really bad. It depends on what people, I guess, decide to do. And yeah, I'm trying to decide, you know, is Detroit going to fix itself up because people are going to step up and do a much better job than government ever could? Or is it going to be that people will step up and start doing well and maybe the gangs and of course, the big gang called the government of Detroit, are they going to come in and squash them out because it makes the government look bad? I mean, or, you know, causes... Or is there going to be some sort of pushback against, you know, the private protection agencies and such?
I try to be hopeful, but, you know, anything I see, the people are so conditioned to looking to government for their solutions that I don't know how that attitude's going to change. You know, and whenever it comes up, it's like, oh, well, what's the city going to do for us, or what's the state or federal government going to do to give us our fair share? You know, that we have problems because they're withholding money from us. You know, so it's always looking to that government for a solution. But, yeah, it's kind of sad.
I mean, on that note, I mean, does anybody here think that it would actually be a problem, you know, at the inception of, you know, a freer society, that people would have to sort of, you know, give business to these non-governmental agencies to protect them from fire or whatever? That, I mean, personally, before I sort of got fairly well read on libertarian solutions to these problems, I mean, it was all foreign to me. Like, I had absolutely no idea of how the government would go and, or how anybody but the government, I mean, would provide something like this. I mean, is it too much of a, you know, is it too much of a leap for most people, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people are, they have trouble dealing with abstract things. Like, you can talk about the ideas and maybe, you know, maybe that's kind of a cool idea, but they need to see it in action. So there's a huge amount of there's this momentum effect, I think, that has to take place. Like, maybe if Detroit just gets off the ground and they start doing good, we'll see very quickly how the rest of the country reacts to it, and maybe people will follow suit.
But don't people see it anyway? I mean, we see insurance companies around attempting to cut costs. Like, I mean, just recently, I know my dad was getting health insurance, and they had him do a physical first, so they would know what to charge him, right? I mean, these they see companies cutting costs. They see auto insurers, you know, settling things rather peacefully, even when there are disputes. And yet, you know, just applying that more universally doesn't seem to work out.
I don't know. I mean, certainly, I think something has to happen. You know, we have to see some sort of major cultural shift. And I think the most important thing is to reach the young generation. I think we need to reach the younger generation and get our message out to people who are, you know, still learning about the world, who don't really have their minds made up about things, and maybe are more, you know, well, yeah, you know, I'm not exactly an old phony myself. I'm only 22, but, you know, to get people in our generation, you know, probably the people under 40 are still fairly open to new ideas. And you can tell that by, you know, the voting patterns as well. Like, look who's voting for Ron Paul. Look who's voting for the Libertarians. Look who's really fed up. It's the people under 40, mostly. Especially like, under 30 crowd. I mean, very liberty-oriented, and there's definitely a lot of distrust of the status quo there. And, you know, that's the best thing to do is look at the next generation, I think, and get them thinking about these new ideas. You know, just bring them up in casual conversation. Just be like, hey, well, you know, what if it worked like this? You know, could this work? Do you think it would work? And you kind of just need it and slowly poke and prod, and you can maybe get them slightly shifted in their viewpoints and plant some seeds.
All right, well, before we wrap this topic up, now, when we were preparing this before the show, the whole idea of private sort of administration of fire protection got me thinking. I had heard a story a while back about back in ancient Rome, one of the members of the first triumvirate, his name was Marcus Licinius Crassus, and one of the ways that he got a hold of all of his riches was actually through monopoly of fire protection. And it turns out that what he would do is when a building was on fire, because there were no other providers of fire protection at all, and this was enforced by law, to my understanding, you know, he would walk up to the owner of the building and make them a deal on the spot to buy their land for incredibly cheap amounts of money. And apparently, he amassed his fortune by eventually collecting almost all of the land in Rome. yeah, you know, yeah. through this method. And I just, I don't know. I mean, I thought it related to the story a little bit.
He set stuff on fire himself too, right? Like, he sent his gangs around and lit stuff on fire.
My understanding is that it was, that's heavily implied, although maybe not proven. I mean, it depends on how the historians wrote.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you're a cynic, I mean, there's certainly an incentive to do so. So, you know, why not?
Well, there was an incentive back in the 1800s when there was wholly private firefighting services. They would go around, start some fires, and then extort money out of people to put them out and go in and rob the house and take whatever valuables they had. And you would be left sometimes with the house they put the fire out, but sometimes they just let it burn anyway.
Yeah, well, a big reason that probably occurred back in the 1800s, if you think about it, like, there was no Angie's List, there was no ratings agency, there was no Google. You just kind of talked to somebody on the street, and they said, yeah, we'll put out your fires for you, and you just had to take it on word. I mean, maybe someone told you something, but there's information sharing was very, very bad back then. Think about it, there was no telephone systems. Back in the 1800s, there was like telegraphs, but there wasn't even like a true telephone system. Roto, you had something to say too.
Yeah. For the listeners who don't know, I come from a third world country. In my city, where I was born, the fire department is entirely voluntary. Entirely voluntary. People who join the fire department join it because they think it's fun to put out fires, and they you know, they have shifts and they're on call and they do training, and they do get like a little bit of money from the government, which is not enough to actually fund their operations. So most of their operations are actually funded by private donations. Interestingly, if you come to think as to what would happen if the government would stop giving them money, the fire department in my city would continue to operate pretty much the way it operates. People are good. The people who actually put out fires, they don't get paid. They do it because they love it. That's how the free market actually does work.
There's actually a lot of voluntary fire stations in the United States. Most small towns have, volunteers.
There's one right down the street from me, and I'm in a major urban area. I'm in the DC metropolitan area. There's volunteer fire departments everywhere. Now, they still get a ton of state funding, but at least they are a good part voluntary. I mean, the people are just volunteers for the most part.
All right, they get quite a bit of money in private donations, right?
Well, think about it. If a volunteer fire department comes to save your house, you're probably chipping some money to them. You'd probably be like, yeah, that's good. And I see them out on the side of the road. Also, you know, they have their own fundraisers and stuff. They'll go around and work with restaurants, or they'll go out and have fun drives, or just, you know, stand out there in the road and just collect donations from motorists. And people will donate a lot of money. I know my folks did that a lot. Yeah, I haven't really ran across them recently, but now that I have enough money to start, you know, giving some of it away to people, that's something I would consider putting my money towards.
Yeah, I wish our local fire department was voluntary. Like, our firefighters often make six figures in the city I live in. It's pretty bad. Like, they start out around $65,000 starting pay. Like, I know someone who went in right after high school. He went in, he was 19 after he passed all his certifications, and he makes almost $70,000 a year.
Not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad when you're in the system. But it is bad when you are the taxpayer of the city.
Yeah. So I think we'll move on to the next topic at this point. I know, Toast, you had something you wanted to talk about.
I certainly do. Okay, so the USA Today had an article recently that's been making the rounds. It's titled, School is Too Easy, Students Report. That article gives some data that says exactly that amongst the findings are that 37% of fourth graders say their math work is often or always too easy, and 57% of eighth graders say their history work is often or always too easy.
Yeah, I think really we can all relate to that, and most people at home can definitely relate with school being just kind of like a waste of time where you sit around, and it's all based on the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, same for me.
I mean, I don't know if that was actually my experience back in high school. I mean, I went to one of the best school counties in I guess all of America, right? And you know, I mean, I was in AP classes and whatever, and you know, I actually did have some teachers in isolated circumstances that would actually sort of push you into you know, your own research or work if they thought it was best for you. But I just can't say that's the case everywhere else in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like it was very teacher-based. You know, like it was just kind of, you know, some teachers would push you, and a lot of other teachers... I had teachers, you know, Toast and I had teachers that were... They would pride themselves on doing as little work as possible. Literally just, like, did not teach. Just didn't do anything. Just let you read the book.
Oh, yeah.
Here you go.
The most popular teachers.
Throw a worksheet at you.
Yeah, the most popular teachers in my high school were the ones that, you know, if you went in the class, you would leave with an A+. Like, you had no work ever. Like, one test was open book, and, like, that's it. No homework. All in-class busy work.
But, that, you know, you don't even need to have tests and tons of work, necessarily, for it to be, you know, educational. Like, yeah, that's the thing. Like, the incentive is the grade, not the learning. You have, you know, this idea that you can get an easy path. You don't have to put forth effort to get the reward. And, you know, it's the path of least resistance. And, you know, most kids will take that. It's not that it's a bad thing. They're being perfectly rational doing so. But the problem is the incentives are set up in such a way that you're basically going there and just drawing on yourself for a couple hours a day. God forbid. I mean, if you're in elementary school... And you have a bad teacher, I know that a lot of elementary schools won't even rotate teachers, especially when you're a younger kid. You're stuck with that teacher the whole day. And if that teacher is not very good, is not interesting, can't keep you focused, can't keep you interested in learning, you're drooling over yourself the entire day, and you learn nothing that year. It is terrible.
I was lucky enough to be part of a pilot program when I was in elementary school. Where it was based on like the middle school, high school model, where you went to different classes for different teachers. And I think we went to 4 different classes starting in 3rd grade. We'd have a teacher for math, one for English, one for social studies. And then we'd have our elective we go to every day for a different teacher.
We had something like that too, right, Toast? Like, we had some rotation starting in, was it 3rd grade or something? Oh, this is way back then.
Oh, it was 3rd grade, yeah.
Yeah, same here. It was starting in 3rd grade. And it was actually good. Because I liked most of the teachers, and most of them were pretty good, except for the English teacher was always the worst. It just felt like, you know, it was kind of like the busy work kind of class where you didn't really learn anything. It was like, how do you spell apple? You know what I mean?
APEL.
Bingo.
You get a gold star.
Yeah.
No, but... I mean, I think one of the problems with this article, though, my issue with it when I was reading, they're asking the children, like, is school too easy? When easy or hard isn't really a good description of the problem with school. I mean, that sort of makes the assumption that, like, oh, well, if we hit this exact point where it's not too easy and not too hard, it'll be good for everybody. And that's just simply not the case.
Yeah, it's a completely subjective term.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, so I would have said myself that school is sometimes too easy and sometimes too hard, and that they're just not good descriptors of the problems that there are. You know, there's no – I mean, children aren't fair to set their own goals. And maybe that's one of the bigger problems with it.
A big part of the whole problem with education in general is it's you shove a bunch of kids – of the same age group, a bunch of 10-year-olds, maybe some, you know, some 9-year-olds, you know, you shove all these kids within a year of each other in the same room and just magically pretend they're all the same. Well, of course they're not. They're all going to mature to different rates. They're all going to be good at certain things and bad at other things. And, you know, when you have all these kids together in one room and you're also handing out these grades and stuff, and everyone knows how it works. There's like the smart kid in the class or a couple of them. And then you have the dumb kids, and you always make fun of the dumb kids, and smart kids get picked on for being too smart sometimes, depending on your school. Or, you know, they get singled as being nerds, geeky, or something like that. They're like, cool. And, you know, you have your other kids that people band together in cliques, of course. And, you know, obviously they do it because they're all trapped with each other, and they have to, you know, kind of identify themselves or, you know, make sure that they have, you know, their group, their tribe. And, you know, when you don't split up kids by what they're actually good at, when you don't give them the freedom to move around and learn at their own rates and own thing, you definitely get a lot of abrasiveness, and it's not good.
Yeah, when you have all those kids together, the smartest kids end up just being done in 5 minutes, and then you end up teaching based on who's the slowest people in the class. So the class can only fully progress when, like, everyone understands every particular concept.
And we have a caller. Yeah, I think we have a caller in line. Where do you want to introduce him?
Sure. We have Sean Doonan, and he wants to speak with us. He has a question. I'm going to pass him through. Hello, Sean. You're online. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you guys?
How's it going, Sean?
Doing good.
Going all right. I just wanted to add in about the what I felt about school. I'm now in college, and I sort of felt that while it might have been difficult, or rather it was at least somewhat of a challenge, but I also feel like that might have been part of that might have been, you know, I come from a very wealthy part of where I'm from, and it was just a rather difficult school, and they prided themselves on being academically rigorous, and so that's really where I come from. And so I think it's more a matter of school to school kind of thing, where one school could be really good about their academics, really pushing kids to perform well, and then some.
This is a private school or a public school?
This is a public school I'm referring to.
So do you think the difficulty was really helpful?
Yeah, I thought being difficult helped push me to it, although that might have just been my own personal motivation to actually do well and accomplish good things while at school.
And was this in high school, or was this before high school?
This is high school, mostly.
If you don't mind me chiming in, I think that a lot of it has to do with, like, the personality of the student. So, like, I know, like, some of us, when we were in school, did some pretty rigorous subjects. I mean, I studied engineering, and that was very rigorous. It was a lot of work, very hard at times. And we did it because we like to rise to the challenge. We like to push ourselves, and it was good for me. It was good for some of us. Other people not do well when it comes to that kind of thing. They need to kind of be handheld a little more, or they need to have, you know, some of a less stressful rat race type environment in which to learn. So I think it definitely is definitely tailored to the individual whether that kind of system works or not. But I mean, as you said, this was in college, that you're experiencing that now in college. And, in college, we have a choice of which college we go to. We get to pick our own program. We can choose what we want to study. So you're going to pick something that you probably have a passion for. Was that more in high school, or is that in college? I might be confused here.
It's okay. This is the first time I've really called into a radio show, so I'm still trying to, get my act together and keep my thoughts straight.
You're among friends.
Well, that's good. This was mostly referring to what I did in high school. To comment further, our school had these different tracks. There was A1, which was your basic college prep, sort of like the 85% solution, if you will. Then you had the honors track, and you had the skills track, which was remedial classes for people who were behind and things like that. Something I thought was really interesting, though, was when you got put into each one of these tracks, you were encouraged not to move out of it, either one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that before from other teachers and students and stuff. It's definitely something where, people kind of get pigeonholed of, like, this is what you are, this is where you're going to become. I think a lot of it has to do with what the origins of the education system, the public education system. Because the way it was back in the day, the idea of the public education system was to produce masses of good, factory workers and other workers. And it was a way to have very obedient workers that had basic skills. And you had this other tier of schooling on top of that, which was like the private institutions, the old guard, colleges and stuff, which were for the elite, the ruling class type people. And that kind of carries over through to today, where we have this track system where it's like, well, you get to go and be this kind of person because, you know, you scored whatever on this test back in when you were six or something. And it's hard to move out of that because you get assigned the teachers that teach to that type of personality or whatever, or you know, like to put you on that kind of track.
Sounds like what happens in a lot of socialist countries, like China, for instance, where you've got those really early exams and then you get pushed into different schools even, and you had no chance to change it afterwards.
Yeah, I was nine. No, earlier, eight. I was maybe seven? Seven or eight, I think. When I was taking exams to get placed, I did the gifted and talented program. I know that exists in some areas of the country. And yeah, it sounds more impressive than it is. But basically, you've got the better teachers for the most part, and you got usually the kids who had a bit better family life or something. You know, usually the parents that actually cared about the kids' education, they kind of pushed for it. I know my parents kind of pushed for it a little bit, though I'm not too familiar about the time because it was so long ago.
Yeah, we kind of have that where I'm from. I was tested for gifted when I was in kindergarten, and I was in gifted all the way up through eighth grade. But I was actually supposed to go to basically, like, I don't know if you guys know what IB, International Baccalaureate, is. We had I had a school around me based entirely on that from 8th grade to 12th. And I was supposed to go to that, but it was a little too far away. And the high school I went to also had an International Baccalaureate program where, like, it kind of preps you for going into, like, political science or engineering, or they kind of focus it based on going up into higher learning courses.
Mm-hmm. Right, we had advanced placement courses, actually, and at least my experience with them was that they were far less work than the other classes. Like, you know, they're supposedly... They actually get you college credit. I went into college with 27 extra credits for taking these silly joke courses where it's the exact same as everything else. Oh, yeah, and you 27? Take this one exam at the end? Yeah.
I got 40. Six out of mine.
I had 40. I mean, it's crazy. You basically had the same courses that would have been, you know, you would have been taking anyway, but they just give you a bunch of college credit for it just because, you know, you're in the top X percent. They're pushing this thing. I think a lot of it is just the colleges nowadays. They expect people to be there for 5 or 6 years. Might as well get a head start and, you know, cut it down to 4 like it's supposed to be or something.
Yeah, actually, I'm from Florida, so we already have good, like, higher education grants. But if you graduated from IB... You actually had a full ride scholarship for 4 years to college, in addition to already having between 20 and 40 college credits.
Wow, that's pretty good. I mean, IB around here, because my brother did it, got you nothing. Maybe some college credits, maybe. So that's a big improvement over the way it is around here.
Yeah, but anyway, so do we anything else to say on this?
Anybody else want to chime in? You know, Sam, wrong opinion. You guys want to say some stuff?
Caller, do you have anything else to add?
No, not really.
I actually had one small question for Sean.
Sure, what's up?
You mentioned that there was you performed well in a high pressure environment, right?
Or
did I confuse that?
You might have confused that, but I'll accept it as true. Go on.
All right. Did you see that have an opposite of positive effect for some people, like to even a small or maybe a great extent even?
I didn't really pay attention to how other people were performing academically. I was mostly focused on getting my own act together and making sure
right.
that I was, you know, on track with my courses, on track with my homework, keeping my grades up, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I know from my own personal experience, when I actually began to care somewhere around my sophomore year in high school, I did really well in high pressure environments, but I also noticed that other people around me, when the heat started to get on, they really suffered. But on the other hand, certain other classes where the teacher was slower, I had a hard time paying attention, but other people excelled in that environment. Best example I can think of is my girlfriend is going to a local community college right now, and she made the mistake of taking an accelerated summer course in math, which is not her strong suit, and it's really taking a toll on her because she is not the pressure-oriented type.
Reminds me of myself. I took an accelerated logic class over summer one time. It was kind of where you had to read like 30 to 40 pages a night and write up a 2-page report every single day. It was a little much for me to handle.
Good lord, but why?
Because logic is for the smart people that should be able to handle it, apparently.
Apparently.
Yeah, well, there's this thing, like, I've noticed in public education, there's this theme where, you know, if we have more time in school, more work, if we just keep kids really, really busy, then clearly, you know, they're going to learn more. But that's totally not true. Like, it doesn't matter, you know, how much time you stick them in schools. It doesn't matter how much time they're in there, you know, getting stuff thrown at them. If it's not quality stuff, if it's not engaging material, if it doesn't get them to think, you can't just take a funnel and sort of shove information down their throats, and it's not going to stick. I mean, they're going to poop it right on out. That's a terrible analogy.
Best analogy I've heard in a while. Ever again.
Do you have something to say, Reto?
I think, do we listen for a bit?
I see an observation on the IRC channel. Yeah, I see an observation on the IRC channel, and I discovered something very interesting. People who go to school, especially when it's a government school, do not get taught practical things, and do not get taught logic. And if they get taught ethics, it has nothing to do with ethics. It has only to do with a long investigation of ethical opinions and no mechanisms to actually evaluate what is actually ethical and what is not.
That's an excellent point. The only logic I ever learned was in mathematical proofs for geometry. And so...
Which isn't really good for the masses.
Exactly.
It's actually not good for the mathematicians either, by the way. So I don't know what they're accomplishing in that.
Shapes, dude. It's like kindergarten all over again, except you gotta measure the angles and talk about, you know, all these different congruencies and stuff.
So many theorems.
Yeah, there's actually a good Molyneux video that goes into detail about this topic. It's Why You're Unemployed, Part 2. And it goes into talking about, you know, how no one really gets taught to be a carpenter or a plumber. And those classes that you could take, like shop classes, those are, like, really looked down upon nowadays. Like, the people who look, like, go into those classes are, like, the stupid kids, the kids who don't really want to do anything, you know. And so it's, oh, you have to go to college, you know, you have to take these classes, and you have to spend all this money on this, all these courses. Even if you just get an art degree, you need to get the degree, right? And you don't have to go into, like, a physical labored skill, even though that might make you close to $100,000 a year. It's like, oh, it's shitty.
Yeah, there's definitely a stigma there. I noticed that, you know, the kids who did go off and do this, like, we had mechanics classes, like, you go work on cars. There was an auto shop at our school, and I thought that was kind of great. It was a cool thing. And I know a lot of kids from who were, you know, smarter kids versus, you know, the not-so-academically inclined kids. Went off and did that, and one of them went off and he works at the auto shop I bring my car to now. So, yeah, it's good for him. I mean, he was working at 18.
A bunch of people walked away from our high school with, like, licenses to work on cars. I mean, that's, yeah, licenses. But they were actually pretty well trained.
Yeah, I think it's a great program. I think we need way more of them. I think instead of forcing kids to sit and learn, you know, Shakespeare and, you know, read, like, terrible British authors... Hey, not that I have hate on Shakespeare, but you know, it doesn't really do anything.
Reading. I love reading Chaucer.
It doesn't do.
I'm
much
sorry.
For
I'm
you
a,
in terms
I'm
of
a theater
money.
Major. I had to stick up for Shakespeare.
Hey, but you chose to do it. I mean, that's your thing. You know, you could always choose to do that if you wanted to. We should give people more choices. Is the thing. Like, I know I had to take English courses. My entire high school career, I had to kept taking English courses, and it was mostly just English literature, and I, you know, really didn't care. I was good at it. I didn't care. It didn't matter. You know, it's just...
I was in the same boat. My English classes just ended up being I had like a really super left wing teacher, and she just used that as her soapbox as to like why government is good and what we need to do more in government to fix this or fix that.
Yeah.
I wish I never could take that class, you know.
Yeah, I think we're probably beating this topic to death here, so it's good of you to call in. Sean, correct?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right.
Great calling in. Really liked having you on the show. And we'll definitely like to have you on in the future. And for all our other listeners, you can call in on Skype, you know, user decline to state. That's one word, decline to state. And we'll have you on the show. All right, take care, Sean.
All right, you too, guys.
Yeah, so what do y'all want to talk about now? I think we had something on scientific peer review, if I'm not mistaken. Like, Wash, yeah, you want to talk about that?
It kind of flows in from the last discussion. I mean, in terms of...
I hear a train in the background over there. Do you have a train by your house?
Well, I live in a switching yard, so yeah, these are coming by all the time, so sorry about
great.
That. So, well, you know, it's like really cheap rent, though, you know. So,
it's the peer review train.
The peer review train, yeah, they're bringing in the reviewers to review our show.
The chew train? Come on, man.
No, it's the chew.
I'm sorry,
train,
I'll shut up. go ahead. Ignore it.
So I was reading an article in Science Magazine a couple weeks ago, and unfortunately I can't link to their article, you know, because it's all locked up in the controlled paper system. But I did link on the Decline to State site a review of the study, and it kind of softens it. But basically, what's going on is the National Science Foundation. Prepared a study where they fooled both people who were presenting papers for review as well as the reviewers to see if the review process was really fair. So they took 55 proposals and they basically told people that, you know, okay, it's going to go through their peer review process. And if you are awarded, you'll get some money or whatever to fund this study. And it happened to be climate related, but that was irrelevant to, you know, to the real study that was really going on. So the 55 people put together 2-page proposals. And if they were selected, then supposedly they would be allowed to write longer proposals and then receive grants. And so this goes on, and the papers go to the review panels, and it was split up in 2 groups. Half the papers were reviewed anonymously. That is, the reviewers didn't know who wrote the papers. And the other set of papers, it showed who was, you know, who actually authored the papers. So, and wouldn't you know it, you know, after the awards were granted, it seemed that the outcome was not quite as expected. To quote from one of the awardees, Shirley Taylor, she was awarded during the evolution round of the Big Pitch. That's what they call this study. She says a comparison of the reviews she got on the 2 versions of her proposal convinced her that anonymity had worked in her favor. An associate professor of microbiology at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Taylor had twice failed to win funding from the National Institutes of Health to study the role of an enzyme in modifying mitochondrial DNA. The format could, quote, remove bias and allow better support of smaller innovative research groups that otherwise might be overlooked. But the current system is definitely a buddy system where it's not what you know, but who you know, where you work, and where you publish, and the rich get richer. So basically, the thought is that, you know, they're being selected not on the basis of the content of the papers, but based on who is listed as an author. Does the reviewer recognize the name? How many authors are listed? Does the topic relate to the material that they are interested in as a reviewer? And so on. It's all part of a fixed system You know, and it kind of exposes the fallacy that peer review is going to lead to the best material. So it's a, you know, you might say it's a scam, and you wonder if, you know, so what's the outcome of this? What will the NIH, you know, say is the outcome, and what will they push? And I see how it's being spinned already in the public papers that go out in front of the press, like on the internet, and they downplay, you know, and they say, you know, they look for flaws in the study, and they're, you know, they're downplaying the whole thing. But the original article was pretty more clear on it was very critical of the whole process. Any thoughts on this? Any comments? Do you guys have an opinion on the peer review system? Do you have thoughts on?
Is it reliable? Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
I definitely think that it's important for us to take a step back and look at, you know, this whole peer review system and everything. The reason it's such a big deal is because science is not a market right now. I mean, science is mostly funded by the state. It's funded by state institutions and universities, large things like the National Science Foundation. It's taxpayer dollars. So, you know, it's one overarching system to rule them all. And you don't have choice between how you do your review processes in scientific community now. Now it's just, you know, you have to do it as we've seen, the kind of political way where, you know, your names are on the papers and people know who you are, and, you know, favors are handed out to the people who are either trusted to do good science or maybe have connections or whatever the reason may be. But there's a level of politics involved. And that goes for any government contracting. I mean, that goes more than just science. It goes for anything that's a government contracting, like the military-industrial complex is a large amount of that kind of heavy, you know, favoring of incumbents, I should say. You know, it's hard to break in. And that can be a good thing and a bad thing. You know, it can be good because, you know, people go to who they trust, who they know to produce good results. But it can also be really bad because, you know, you can overlook potentially really good stuff out there simply because you're ignoring things because you're not part of the inside group. It's hard to break in, hard for new people to break in. And it can reduce the quality of the research being put out. Or it can even just lead to a lot of bad stuff getting pushed simply because it's a favor to the people. Toast, you want to chime in?
I had one thing to say, though, that, I mean, if anybody's really skeptical about what the article is saying, that it's actually a very political process, I mean, just look at, I mean, everyone knows this goes on. I mean, you take, you know, like an intro philosophy class, and, you know, you are the loud kid, and of course your TA is going to take it out on you when he grades your paper. I mean, there are people up at the top who are, you know, to some extent deciding, you know, which of these papers are being taken seriously. And at all of the levels in education, everyone knows this goes on. It's a popularity contest.
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's all part of the big education, scientific research cartel. It's all one big conglomerate. Like, you get the undergraduate students being taught, you know, one version of the science, or, you know, one side of things, the stuff that the people at the top are proposing is the best way to look at stuff, especially when it comes to things that aren't truly scientific, like economics or philosophy, that are taught more as, you know, opinionated liberal arts things. And, you know, you go up the ladder, you have the people that apply to graduate schools are the ones who kind of buy into that stuff. Who get accepted, who are, you know, have the higher grades and such, who, you know, are more interested in that material because, you know, that's what they've been taught. So, you know, people that disagree with that, they get frustrated really quickly. A lot of them don't want to continue pursuing their career in academia through that. And so the people that continue to pursue into graduate school and post-grad are the people that kind of buy into it. And then on top of that, you know, those people get paid very, very little to do all the real research work for these institutions. Like, you know, if you're a person working on climate science, you know, and you're some sort of, I don't know, meteorologist or biologist or something, and you have interest in environmental science and climate change or something, and you're going to be taught that the establishment version of things, you're going to go in and you're going to have to repeat that. And you go up to the graduate level, and you're doing your research, you have to produce results that will appeal to your superiors so you can get your thesis approved, so you can have good stuff to show them, so you can get your degree. And, you know, you can't get paid for saying, I found nothing. You can't get your degree for saying stuff that doesn't further the people's at the top, doesn't further their agenda. And it's all about economics, really. These are just a layer of incentives on top of each other. And it's all because of this monopoly system we got.
Well, right. I mean, there are people who carve their own careers by saying that there is more research to be done, for one.
Yeah. You don't write your own, resignation letter. You don't sign yourself off. You don't sign a suicide note, you know, by sending in, well, it turns out there's no more science to be done. False alarm, global warming's not real. False alarm, we actually know, everything there is to know about, the mating behaviors of polar bears or something, whatever the heck the research is.
Well, it's like the classic problem of distribution of goods. I mean, it's like the old Soviet system where, oh, yes, comrade, the production is up 21% this year, and, they accomplish it by, burning half the grain or something. I mean, you got to fake the numbers in order to make yourself look good. And again, the promotion is based not on, productivity or results, but it's based on who you know and, who do you satisfy and personal connections and things. So, it's a classic problem of distribution of resources. So, how do you distribute limited resources? And the anarcho-socialists, they dismiss that problem. They evade it. Okay, good.
Yeah, you want to patch them on through?
I hear some Skype noises. We're processing him through the inner tubes right now.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hey. Hey, guys. How's it going today?
How do you wish to be identified, caller?
I am Rufus Raffle Punch.
We'll just call you Rufus. How's that sound?
Thanks for calling in again, Rufus. Fantastic.
You guys aren't hearing any echoes or anything, are you?
Sounds great.
No, you're coming in good.
No, you're good, yeah.
All right, cool. I know that you're kind of in the middle of a topic about scientific peer review, correct? Or is that passed now?
No, that is
correct.
We're
still kind of in the middle of it.
I think someone was trying to segue into ANSOC. Anarcho-socialist, that is.
Not type of sock.
Not a sock.
Well, I've been trying to wait.
Underwear.
go for it, caller. What do you got?
Yeah, okay, well, something particularly awesome happened to me last week at my job involving, I work for a cable company. I do tech support for a company called Charter Communications.
Intimate encounter in a closet?
What?
Intimate encounter in a closet?
Charter Communications, I do tech support, over-the-phone tech support for internet and video and things like that. And, one of the markets we cover is Auburn, Alabama. And I know a lot of people think of, like, college football, but when I hear Auburn, Alabama, I think of the Mises Institute. And for 4 years, I've been waiting for a call from somebody I would recognize. And it finally happened. I got a call, believe it or not, from none other than Jeffrey Tucker the other day, actually.
Oh, wow.
That's the best kind of phone call.
Soothing.
Did you instantly recognize his voice, or did he have to introduce himself?
I instantly recognized his voice. Before I even saw his name, I was like, holy cow. I went absolute fanboy on him. I went completely unprofessional. I was like, I'm a gigantic fan. Will you please let me talk to you about capitalism for like a minute?
Did you ask him what color bow tie he was wearing?
No, I realized after the call was over, I really should have mentioned something about a bow tie, but I just blanked. Aww. Like, it was hard to talk because I went complete stupid on him. But
were you giggly like a little girl?
I was. I talked to him about his book and everything. It was just it was really intense and surreal. And he invited me to friend him on Facebook and everything, and it's just like a whole other, like, I went into hero worship mode, right? Is anyway, so it got me thinking. I really don't understand. I told my girlfriend about it, and she is not a libertarian, and she's not interested at all, honestly. And I couldn't really make her understand. I mean, she was happy that I met somebody that, you know, I admire, but she doesn't understand me. And I was just kind of hoping that you guys could, you know, help me bridge a gap with her. Like, I don't really know how to approach the idea of liberty with her. And how do you guys handle it with your significant others or family members? And,
well,
you know, I just get your thoughts on that.
Is she interested in politics at all, or is she not? Is she just, like, apolitical?
It actually scares her. Like, she doesn't know how to approach it. Like, she thinks about it, and it just makes her, like, I talk about how I think that, you know, things are coming to a head in an economic sense sometime in the near future, and she actually wants to change the subject because it bothers her so much.
Well, I'm going to chime in and say something, which, you know, maybe Throwaway can back me up on this, that it might have something to do with the way she was raised. Perhaps, like, she was raised in such a way that she's not supposed to speak out her own opinions, that, you know, she was kind of supposed to be a little quiet and just kind of accept what the family said. And, you know, I think that there's certainly something in the background there that's making her afraid of having this open discussion. Because people, you know, don't rationally shy away from a discussion they don't have a huge involvement in personally. If it's just, you know, like, I don't really shy away from discussions about ice cream flavors. I don't get afraid of that. You know, it's not a big deal for me. And likewise, you know, people who haven't had, you know, political opinions of theirs silenced before shouldn't really have a problem, you know, discussing politics. So, what are your thoughts on all that?
Honestly, she has a real problem with it, and it's of a massive interest to me, and I wish I could somehow ease her into it. Like, if I had a way to just sort of bring her slowly into it, like if there are subjects that are easy to bring up first, and then sort of get her, you know, in a day is not the right word, but slowly bring her interest into it. Maybe I could get her into it, but, you know, I don't want to change her or make her different. I just want her to understand, because I don't think she understands me. I've tried to explain, you know, the non-aggression principle and voluntarism, and her eyes just glaze right over. You know, we're such different people, and I just thought you might be able to offer some sort of insight, because I certainly have hit up against the wall on it. She doesn't really understand.
What are some of the things that she does? Like, what is she, like, what's, don't give up too much, but, you know, like, what is she, what's her profession, maybe, or what are some things that she likes to do in her everyday life? Try to find things like that, and mention how the state can affect, in any manner, negatively, you know, how that influences certain parts of her life. Don't be political about it, like, oh, those damn Republicans, or oh, those damn Democrats. You know, just give us an example. Give us something to work with here. We'll try to give you a suggestion. But you are right when you say you can't make her want to be a libertarian if she just has no interest at all in learning that kind of economic philosophy or personal philosophy, then that's just it.
You could always approach it from the moral argument as well,
if that's what she's interested in.
All right, Rufus, I'd like to... I have a question for you, and then I have a couple of suggestions depending on the question. Tell me something. How do you normally interact with your girlfriend? At what level do you normally interact with her? And how does it make you feel when she gets tense?
Well, when she gets tense... Did you say when she gets tense?
Yeah, well, she tends to get tense when you discuss. That's correct. When you talk politics with her, for whatever the reason, that whatever your topic that you're talking about, and you try to approach it from a libertarian perspective, how does she feel? What do you perceive?
Oh, okay. Well, generally, we don't talk very much on an intellectual level. Like, life goals, things like that, we have the same as far as, you know, where we want to be. You know, the same sort of things make us laugh. And, you know, that's where our common interests lie. But she, but when she gets tense about anything, like, I just roll over and just shut up immediately, because I cannot handle if she gets mad or irritated or annoyed. I just, for whatever reason, I'm just not able to take that and continue moving with it. So I just shut down and move on to a new topic.
Interesting.
So,
all right. So that's.
I'm sorry.
I think he dropped out.
I don't know. But I'll pick up.
No, he's still here. Yes, he's still here.
We're talking about you, Roto.
You kind of said something and then dropped for a bit. I'll pick up from here though. Because I mean, is this more of a thing like when this stuff comes up? Is it her asking questions? Is she asking any questions? Is she showing any sort of inquisitiveness, or is this going to be? Is this more of a you're trying to subtly or not so subtly bring up these ideas?
It's usually me trying. She doesn't ask questions about things like that, and it's unfortunately not subtle. I tend to hit it with a hammer, basically, instead of sort of ease it in there. And it, yeah, it's
you
a problem.
You don't want to do that, my friend.
I know it. And it I always end up apologizing.
You really gotta wait for her to give you a clue. She's not gonna do it consciously, I guarantee you that. But she's gonna mention something, and you'll be able to slip something tiny in there. Like, I don't know, for example, maybe she gets caught speeding one day and gets pulled over. You know, you can mention something like, you know, isn't it pretty shitty that police are out there just to kind of get money from you for doing things that don't hurt anybody, like going just a little bit over a speed limit that they just decide is okay just because they feel like it. You know what I mean? You can just slip tiny things in there like that, and she'll be like, oh, you know, yeah, she'll probably see reason that way.
Yeah, try to talk about any small part that affects her life personally.
Even more subtle than that. I mean, especially ask her how it makes her feel, like when she's, you know, been pulled over, you know, say been pulled over by a cop. Ask her, you know, were you intimidated? You know, were you concerned, you know, for your safety or something like this? You know, did you feel bad about it?
Yeah, I think it's those little things actually that can really make a big difference. Even if at the very moment, you know, you're getting sort of dismissed, like, you know, maybe the getting pulled over scenario, you know, and so. And you sort of make a little offhand comment about how it kind of sucks that you know, the police are sort of they're giving you a ticket for not doing anything really wrong. Well, you know, even if you get dismissed in that conversation, I think it makes a little difference.
No, but this is Quash speaking. I you don't want to make it like you're some kind of, like, evangelist who's always bringing it up, you know, oh, well, you know what Ron Paul would say about something like this. You know, you know, it's got to be subtle, but it's got to be honest, too. And it's got to speak to her own interests. You know, it's like if she's not interested in sports, you're not going to be real successful dragging her into sports. You know, but if you can kind of find some sport-like thing that she's kind of interested in, you can kind of find a way to participate in that. You know, so I guess my question is, you know, what does she have any real interest, any hobbies, things that she loves to do? You know, and would there be a way to bring that into the conversation and allow her to see your viewpoint of how you look at things politically rather than, you know, try to force things on her?
Well, we love to go to football games, and we like basically all the same TV shows. Like, we were watching 24 the other day, and you know, I like to point out various things that are absurd, you know, like it's an enjoyable show, but I like to point out things that are absurd about what Jack Bauer does in that show and the kinds of people he is up against and how they're, you know, caricatures and, you know, I try not to use the word imperialism, but that's what I feel like when I'm watching that show, you know, and sometimes I go overboard, and I think our biggest interests lie in we love to go to basketball and football games, and we love to watch a lot of the same TV shows. She's not interested in video games like I am, and she loves reality TV, and I have absolutely no idea why. She watches more reality TV shows than anybody I know. So maybe I could somehow use that. Like, if I sit there and watch it with her, maybe I could point out little things every now and again, instead of being overbearing like I sometimes tend to do. I tend to really evangelize or, you know, get on a soapbox about things, and I think that really drives her away. I think you guys are really right about that.
This is fairly interesting. Sorry to interrupt you. I really wanted to ask you something.
Please do.
So you have a fairly good relationship with your girlfriend, normally. But when the topic of politics kind of looms in the air, she feels... she experiences negative emotions, right?
Yeah, you could say that.
So you'd prefer not to have to talk, not to even touch the topic, right?
I mean, I want to be able to have a conversation with her, but it bothers her to a degree that I can't really it bothers me because it makes me angry, but it scares her to have that discussion. I don't think it bothers her, it makes her uncomfortable, and I don't know how I can, you know, but I think it's just me, honestly. I really think like it's just me. I'm the problem.
No, I don't think you're the problem. You're experiencing what every single human being experiences, and she's also experiencing the same things. I mean, we're human, right? We're actually talking about who gets to control whom when we're talking about politics. It is completely natural that she would feel tense by talking about the topic, and you would feel tense and angry at the same time, right? So the question is, how do you achieve constructive dialogue between your girlfriend and you such that you don't experience those bad emotions and you're able to actually figure things out rationally, right?
Yeah, that really puts it in perspective for me. I think you guys have really offered some excellent advice as far as keeping it subtle. Like, that's really not what I've been doing, and I, you know, really... thanks for that, guys.
Well, the other option is the immersion technique. You could tell her, "Hey, honey, I planned a vacation. We're going in 2 weeks, or is it 3 weeks? We're gonna go, and we're gonna have a great time in Florida. And take her to the Tampa convention. It'll be a total immersion thing, and she'll be, you know, forced to deal with it all. And she'll either leave you or learn to love it."
I thought it might be fun to take her.
Oh, by
to
the way, I think that's actually a terrible idea. But yeah, so don't. You know, don't take our advice as, like, legal or whatever.
We're just a bunch of dudes on the internet.
As am I. Have you guys had any trouble with girlfriends or boyfriends or family?
Oh.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure everyone has. Go for it.
Well, here's the nutshell. My family is largely Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm an atheist and an anarcho-capitalist. What does that tell you? So, you know. Yeah.
That is good.
Your problem probably seems small now, doesn't it?
It's worse than the Whore of Babylon.
Oh, man. Yeah. Maybe a rant for another time would be called for. But we're helping our friend here.
Yeah, my family's just really liberal. My brother's in the Navy, and my other brother is looking at joining a military med school. So... you can see where I stand in that issue.
So they're going to beat the patients up with the magic stick of wellness?
Magic stick of wellness does tend to make you feel better when you forget about your emotions because you can only feel pain.
Yeah, no, I mean, myself, I have a little bit of experience being sort of dismissed just, you know, out of maybe anxiety or whatever. I mean, just that... I mean,
that dissonance.
Sorry, what?
I said that dissonance.
Oh, I mean, so my parents are very conservative, and they're like active conservatives. You know, they watch Fox News like all of the time. Like, I guarantee it's on right now. And I try to, you know, pursue sort of moral argument avenues of reaching out to them. And, you know, I have the experience all the time that, like, you know, they're very firmly against abortion. And, you know, I mean, I very much dislike abortion too, but I want to know their moral reasoning for it. And so I ask, you know, like, some question on the morality of it, because, you know, I'm really interested in that. I read a lot of philosophy, and then they just give me this glare and they say, like, I don't want to have this conversation right now. And, you know, the whole thing is that, like, they don't want to have that, even though it's really important to me, and they say they care about me, and yet I feel like they're just dismissing, you know, a big part of who I am just because they don't want to have the conversation. And I wish I had better advice to give, but, you know, that's not something I don't have a good route out of that one.
Well, I mean, you guys have really actually been great tonight. Thanks for all your help and advice. I mean, you know, so far, I mean, 3 episodes in, I think this show is really great, and I just love listening to it.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
What was your favorite talk so far?
You mean besides the one where I got to chat with you guys? My guess would be the Bitcoin session in the first episode. I don't really use Bitcoin, but I find it an interesting academic topic, I guess. I like the technical stuff, I suppose. And I really thought the private fire protection subject is really interesting, because I like to imagine these grand hypotheticals of an ANCAP future, and, you know, like Machinery of Freedom by David Friedman really sparked my imagination early in my libertarian evolution. And, you know, just thinking about things like private fire protection, for some reason that just excites me, and I'm sure some of you probably understand why that is.
David
Friedman
not,
did the same thing for me.
You can spend all day just imagining what could be, you know?
Yeah,
freedom
absolutely.
Boner. Hey, man, it was nice talking to you. I hope the crap that fell out of our mouths was of some use to you. We really appreciate your input, and thanks for listening to the show, man.
Oh, absolutely. You guys have a great evening, okay?
Yeah, you too.
Have a fantastic evening.
Well.
So where that last caller took us, I think, was pretty good with his questions and his story about his girlfriend, because I imagine he does a little bit of this, but something I submitted to the Decline to Say channel probably garnered more upvotes than I think anything we've had. So this was something that I pilfered from the R Technology channel, or subreddit, but it was on teenage sexing, and I'll read the first paragraph and you'll understand why it was making its way around the inner tubes so well. Under most existing laws, if our findings were extrapolated nationally, several million teens could be prosecuted for child pornography. Explains a new study on teen sexting. Yeah, that's right. They use that term sexting in the article, which finds that a whopping 28% of teenagers text fully nude pictures of themselves. We took a dive into the much reported pediatrics and adolescent medicine article and found some weird insights into the 21st century trend that is quickly becoming the norm among teenagers. And then they get racial is the best part about it. They said white kids love sexting more than any other demographic. And they list off Hispanic, African American, and Asian. White students reported sexting in the highest percentage, 35%, nearly double that of Asians, 19. African Americans were a somewhat distant second at 27%, followed by Hispanics, 21%, and Asians afterwards. They don't give a percentage there. And because of how provocative it is, you can see kind of how this, again, was circulating pretty virally. But in terms of, you know, the implications for our views, we were talking about, you know, sometimes these things come up, as our last caller said, you know, naturally between you and the lady friend or you and the guy friend. But I guess I'm looking for you guys to weigh in. What does this seem? Does this, you know, how much invasion is this, and how absurd that we can just kind of talk about studies that cite that millions of teens.
I have a question Did the article say whether these kids are being prosecuted for sexting? Like,
so what this article, as I took it, it's kind of extrapolating. They did a study, and they're trying to tell us, you know, roughly how what percentage of kids are sexting, and if we apply our laws rigorously, what the laws actually are, which makes them unable to give their consent. They're not considered people with their own volition and their own, you know, they don't own their own body, I guess, in a sense yet. So if they're to go and do this, they are violating laws. People who receive them are violating laws because they're trafficking and exchanging pornography. Even though this is willing, they're giving away pictures of their own body that's being sent to somebody who wants to receive it. They're essentially what they're doing, Toasty Time, is they're extrapolating this out and said if these laws were strictly, you know, knowing what we know, this is how many millions of people would be, you know, breaking a law.
It's a bad law, clearly. I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. I always thought that the whole, you know, the things about teenage sexuality in general are the laws are really convoluted. They vary from state to state like crazy. And, you know, the whole point is, like, if a girl, you know, who's, you know, kind of all sexually curious or whatever, having their first sexual relationship or something, and she's, you know, say 15 or something, or 16, or boy, you know, it doesn't really matter. And they, you know, text their superior or other, be it a boy or a girl, you know, these days. And, you know, they text pictures of themselves to their superior or other. You know, who does it help when you take them at gunpoint and, you know, you put them in prison or you fine them or even just the simple label of being a sex offender? And being, you know, a sex offender is a serious problem. Like, you know, that stuff follows you around for life. You can't get out of that database. You're there forever.
Yeah, and I want to make the point, though, that these things went around when I was in high school, too. And that was, how many years ago? Oh, God. Like 6 years ago or something now. Was when I first saw, I guess somebody had it on their phone. And they were like, hey, like, check this out. This is so cool. And I don't know what the laws are, but, you know, whoever had it on his phone would be in jail. You know,
something like that actually happened at my high school. It was some football player. He was 18, and he had a video on his phone where he was having sex with these two girls. They were like 15 and 16, and he was showing his friends. And one day, he's showing like a group of like five or six people, and then the SRO, the school resource officer, just walks up behind him and just grabs him by his shoulders. He's like, "What are you doing?" And he ended up going to jail for distributing child pornography. He went to jail for distributing child pornography.
Did he get royally screwed over?
The charges eventually got dropped.
Oh, well, that's good, I guess.
Although, I think it had a lot to do with his status. He actually ends up, he's playing in an NCAA. Like,
it doesn't really matter.
He's playing in a tier one school right now.
Like, it doesn't really matter for in this case, because the kid, you know, the charges were dropped. And what is he going to say when he goes to find a job, and then they check the references, and they look for the arrest record, and then he's arrested. And they will just tell him, you know, hey, we can't hire you because you have an arrest record. They're not going to say that to him. They're just going to lowball or ignore him or blackball him, and he'll never get a chance to say, you know what, I was arrested on because of a bad law, and I was declared innocent. Or the charges were dropped. It's like the typical thing that you could. It's basically you already have to apologize for not having done anything wrong. And this is what's wrong with society, that you have to apologize for not doing anything wrong. It's terribly bad.
You have to apologize for the state arresting you for something that you didn't do.
Incredibly,
it's
right?
It's ridiculous.
And I'll add a little bit more from the article. It says, you know, and it said several million was the number, and this was in quotations. Several million teens could be held liable for child pornography. And then, you know, as this law, which I think we can all agree is just kind of sick, it's not even consistent. So as some states do not define inappropriate sexual behavior as only between an adult and a minor. So that's getting at, you know, these aren't consistently enforced. It might be, you know, in some cases, like I was saying earlier, both parties might be, you know, committing a crime, a quote-unquote crime. The prevalence of sexting has put some experts in the awkward position of pressing for laxer child pornography laws. so that curious teenagers aren't branded as pedophiles. And I mean, I see there being an obvious solution. You know, a nonviolent interaction shouldn't be criminalized. But it's funny to me that it's not even brought up in this article at all. It's purely, should we ease up on it? It's not given a second thought. Well, maybe we don't need this at all. Maybe it's nonviolent. It's just, okay, we'll just recalibrate somehow to another nonsensical level.
Right. I mean, I think the reason they tiptoe around things like that is just because this is such a hot button issue. I mean, you turn on anything in the mainstream media, and the moment you say, like, loosen child pornography laws, I mean, you're immediately branded as some pedophile lover and, like, easy on, you know, sex offenders or whatever. And you can't even say these things, you know, outside of, you know, internet sites that I actually haven't even read before, like TechCrunch like this. I mean, not a lot of people read it.
One of the most ridiculous parts is you can be over 18 and have sex with someone who's under 18. Like in my state, it's the law of consent is 16 to 24. So if you're 16, you can consent with somebody up until the age of 24. But having a picture on your phone of that person that you're having sex with is illegal. Even some states, you're allowed to get married at 16 or 17. But you can't have a picture of your wife that's naked, because that's child pornography.
Oh, and I mean, another thing, just that these laws are kind of ridiculous. Because the age of consent here in Virginia is 18, legally, and, you know, it isn't really enforced, which is great. You know, not enforcing crazy laws is good, but the laws would state that two 17-year-olds having sex are raping each other. True story.
You're right. If you take it literally, that's kind of what it's saying.
Huh. But isn't rape not consensual? And these people are consensually trading photographs.
Oh, it's statutory rape, technically. But you are labeled as a sex offender for that.
More properly termed arbitrary rape.
Or state.
Yeah.
More like the state's raping you. I think that's actually pretty close to what it is.
Right. Do we,
So, Rutto, you had something else to talk about?
Is that about it, then?
Yeah, I think that's it on that topic. Yeah, we're gonna move on to, the big topic for the evening.
Oh my.
Yeah, this is some good stuff here. The juicy topic.
Gonna take up.
We were going to talk about the elephant in the room in the voluntarist liberty world, which is the Stefan Molyneux versus David Gordon debate. Yeah. So
looking forward to it.
Yeah. So
fascinating, huh?
I'm gonna give some background on this really quick. Stefan Molyneux is a philosopher, an internet philosopher, as it were. But, you know, he has some real formal philosophy background, and, you know, he's a big. Yeah, I mean, he's a big name in the liberty community. He goes around and speaks to all the big events and stuff, and he's done a heck of a lot for the community, putting out tons and tons of content, like over, 2,200 podcasts or something. It's absurd. He's produced so much content, and a lot of really good stuff. And he produced this book called Universally Preferable Behavior, also known as UPB. And this is supposed to be, like, the next evolution in philosophy. It's supposed to be, you know, a rational proof of secular ethics is what he calls it. And, you know, he makes a lot of really bold claims in there, and he's like, well, this is supposed to tackle some of the big, most important problems that we've ever had in ethics, and, you know, let me give my best shot at it. And he, you know, makes a lot of big hefty claims in there. And then there's this other guy, David Gordon, who is a writer and a member of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and he picked up this book, went through it, and tore it to pieces with a bit of vitriol in there. He definitely seemed like he was not too happy with Stefan personally, too. It was not a great review. And the two of them have been going at it back and forth over the philosophy. Yeah, the article was titled The Molyneux Problem. So,
you know. So what is UPB?
UPB is, Brother, do you want to take this? Because this is really your thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to say one thing. Actually, several things. The first thing is, yes, Steph is a very well-known figure in the libertarian and anarcho-capitalist community. Full disclosure, I do actually donate to his show. He runs a show called Free Domain Radio. I've been listening to the show for about 7 years now, so you know where I'm coming from. I do like UPB. I don't agree with everything that UPB says, but I do think that UPB actually does allow you to arrive to a conclusion that is quite similar, if not identical, to the entire libertarian and anarcho-capitalist philosophy and idea set. So UPB, what it is it is a framework to test theories, sort of like what the scientific method is in the realm of descriptive theories, right? When you have a descriptive theory that describes some aspect of reality, you would like to be able to test it. UPB pretends to do the same for prescriptive theories. That is to say, we're not talking about how things are, we're talking about how things ought to be. If with a condition, if what you want to do is ethical, right? If you're interested in ethics, then you should use UPB to test your theories before you actually act. And the theories always refer to human action, right? So having said that, I have a couple of ideas, but I'd like to ask you guys, what do you think?
Yeah, I've read about half the book so far. I had, you know, first noticed it with Gordon's article. And I'd seen other reviews by Gordon before, and I'm like, well, gosh, this sounds kind of harsh. But what he was saying wasn't real clear either, and I'm like wondering, is there something personal here? And it just wasn't coming through really well. So then I read Molyneux's rebuttal, and that was like a lot of reiterations, and it sounded like they were quibbling on some words, and I'm like, well, that's not really addressing the issues either. And then, you know, and then Gordon responds again, and I'm like, well, they're still going around the issue. So I started reading the book today, you know, and first off, I'm surprised on how well written it is. It was much more readable than I was expecting, especially with the way they were straining at certain things. You know, and I do take some issue with certain things, but overall, I'd say it's pretty good and not too far off from, you know, from you know, a reasonable explanation of the, you know, the libertarian or even ANCAP position. So, I'm starting to wonder what more is behind this issue, because the material seems pretty good, even though it may have some valid criticisms.
I personally think that. I mean, the way that Gordon behaved turned me off a little bit. That's not to say that I stopped reading him. I actually read his entire article, and then I read Steph's response. And after that, I read David Gordon's response, a rebuttal or rejoinder to, you know, Steph's rebuttal. I don't think that David Gordon has acted with enough decorum. Now, that's not to say that his arguments are valid or invalid because he misbehaved, right? But for me, it's like kind of like a turn off. It's a turn off when somebody engages an argument, a philosophical argument, with a negative. Let's be fair. I am pretty harsh on critics, and I'm pretty harsh on people when they say things that are less than correct, so to speak, or they are verbally abusive. I'm not. Not a big fan of people who do that. I think that Steph responded to David Gordon's article not in kind. I think Steph actually played it with decorum. I think that David Gordon, in both occasions when he has referred to Steph's work and he has referred to Steph himself, has committed a number of fallacies. And that bothers me because I'd like to see him treat Steph treat his argument at face value, right? And if his argument is wrong, he should be able to disprove it without resorting to emotional manipulation. I think there has to be something behind it, and it has to do something with the Mises Institute and the general dislike of Stefan Molyneux that the Mises Institute has. I wonder why that is.
I've got a little bit of a theory as to why Gordon seems to be responding to Stefan's ideas in somewhat of a vitriolic manner, if you guys would be willing to entertain me. I can't take credit for finding this, but I was reading through one of the discussion threads about this whole thing on the FDR forums today, and a user by the name of Hannibal commented on a juicy bit by another user by the name of Anarcho B, I think it was, of another review done by Gordon of a book by George H. Smith. And I won't go through the whole review, but Gordon uses similar poisoning the well tactics, as it were, and very thin, borderline strawman sorts of comments against some of the things that the author brought out in that book, largely because it would seem that the author is attempting to create a logical proof for why atheists do not need to present proof that God does not exist. And what Stefan is doing with UPB, whether this is exactly his primary goal or not, is creating an ethical system that does not rely on the existence of a God or some other kind of spiritual entity. And we know that Gordon is a firm believer in a God of some sort, most likely a Christian God. And it's my theory that he's reacting in a similar manner to Stefan's version of UPB because of Gordon's own personal bias towards the idea that morality can only exist because there is a God.
And the sad thing is, what's the topic? It's like logic and reason and objectivity. And sadly, we can't get around our own, you know, lack of objectivity in removing ourselves from the discussion, you know, in the things becoming emotional now, it seems. So that's kind of sad.
I think we get a caller online.
Cool.
Patch Wonder. All right, who do we have on
we
the line
to
today?
We seem to have lost our caller.
Oh, we lost them?
Uh-oh.
Can you call him back?
I'll continue trying. In the meantime, we should continue with the topic, because I'm not sure if it'll work.
Yeah, well, I was going to switch it, you know, a little bit here and get into more of the specifics about UPB itself, because I think we're all in agreement that David Gordon kind of had some ad hominem pokes and...
Oh,
was,
yeah.
Was it less than, you know...
He definitely felt like he was almost, like, willingly ignorant of what Steph was actually talking about at a couple times.
Yeah, well, it certainly felt like he was a bit of a...
Playing, like, the contrarian.
Yeah. All right, so I think we have a caller online again.
Yeah, hey.
Hey, there we go. So who's calling in?
I'm Rep Mac.
Oh, hello,
hello
Rep Mac.
I'm semi-infamous. Famous.
We know who you are.
Yeah.
What's going on, man?
Well, I'm just calling to talk about Stefan Molyneux, because you guys know I disagree strongly with him, so...
Please, go ahead.
Well, first point is, what religion is David Gordon? I've tried to look for if he's religious or not, and I can't find any, so... Like, just one, like, because you come up with this, like, idea that he is, in fact, biased against Molyneux, because Molyneux is an atheist. So, I just want to know, like, how you get, where have you read that he's religious? Like, is he Catholic? Is he Protestant? Like, what is he?
I don't know if he holds any kind of denomination, but the kinds of arguments that he has made indicates that he does believe in some kind of God, at any rate. More likely than not,
right,
because
now.
Of geographical accident, he's some form of Christian. That's just a guess based on
yeah,
I mean, he was born in 1948. How many people were atheists back then? How many people that old?
Yeah, but I mean, Murray Rothbard is an atheist. Was an atheist or agnostic at least?
Was
he?
I thought he. What was?
Yeah,
he
was. He's a
agnostic
Jew that was agnostic
Jewish.
Or Murray Rothbard or atheist. I'm pretty sure. And so
yeah, but he was raised Jewish though. I mean, David Gordon is not Jewish.
Yeah,
far,
yeah.
Hey, Rep Mac, this is Rutto here.
Oh, you guys can just call me Mac.
Oh, sure. Mac, how you doing?
fine.
Well, the first thing is it's good actually to have you here in the show, and the second thing is I'd like to apologize to you for the audio quality. It's going to be a little bit choppy when we actually publish the radio show on their website, because apparently the computer that is actually recording Skype calls is not powerful enough. It's good to have you here, and please go ahead, continue raising your points.
Okay, so the first point is Molyneux is not a philosopher. Like, he's no experience, and the biggest reason to show that he's not a philosopher is David, at the end of David Gordon's article, where he says his facile intelligence, like, he thinks he doesn't have to work. Like, throughout Molyneux's book, you see that Molyneux doesn't actually try and work. Like, he doesn't go through the philosophical...
Molyneux has a master's in philosophy.
No, Molyneux has a master's in history. He did a history paper on the effects of philosophy.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong, but if I recall correctly, Steph has a master's in the history of philosophy.
It's a master's of history, and he did his thesis on the effects of certain philosophers.
Correct.
In
yes.
history. That's so it's
yes.
it's not so it's a master's of history, not a master's of history of philosophy. That's just what he decided to do his thesis on.
Like, now, the question is, is it relevant to the point that you're making? Because we're not masters here. None of us is a master. We can still kind of tell, you know, truth from falsehood somehow.
Yeah, and like he said, like, that's actually a good point. He says in his book, like, murder, rape, and all these things are wrong. And he's like, obviously they're obvious, but if he was like a true philosopher, he would like go to the epistemological level of why we know these things are wrong or why they're actually wrong. He never actually does that. He only uses that as his like benchmark
prove what is UPP. A true philosopher? I mean, can you define true philosopher?
A person that's actually trained, that knows what they're doing, like someone that actually is adequate and knows actual philosophy, like Molyneux.
But how do you how do you tell people who are, adequately trained? How do you tell them from not people who're not, right?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. It'd be kind of, you know, by the rigor of their arguments and also by the critiques that they're given, like if they're good or not, if they're an actual quality. And
wait. You're saying that you know if somebody's a good philosopher because of democracy?
Because of democracy?
I'm not being facetious with the question. You're saying because of the critiques that they received, but you know, Socrates was murdered. He was ordered to drink hemlock because of the critiques he received, right? And we can say he wasn't a great philosopher, but he was a philosopher, like a true philosopher to by any definition, right?
Yeah, but because a dogmatic state killed him doesn't mean anything. Like
that's
a dogmatic dictator state. My argument is not. My argument is that actual people would, like philosophers, other people, colleagues would go with him. Other philosophers would read his stuff. He would be in peer-reviewed articles with other philosophers. It would be looked at, and people would write about it, critique it, and things like that. The only, like, the biggest people that have done this is, like, David Gordon, who's a libertarian, who goes soft on him because he's a libertarian. If any real philosopher had gone up against Molyneux, like, that was from academia, like, from an actual university, that was liberal, they would completely destroy him. Like Robert Nozick, he was a libertarian philosopher that was respected because he's actually trained and knew what he was doing, whereas Molyneux isn't. I've ran into the fallacy a lot today that, well, academia wouldn't, like, they wouldn't take it because they're, you know, they feed off the state, so they don't want to accept anything, they don't want to look at anything that's against the state. But they would look at it, they would appreciate his skill as a philosopher, but they may disagree with his outcomes. But, well, like, no one has actually come out and said...
People's arguments should be... Sorry to interrupt, but I just want to get this point across. Like, people's arguments exist outside of the person making them. Like, the arguments stand on their own. The arguments do not depend on who's making them. I can provide an argument, and you can provide an argument, the same argument, and despite the fact that people may like me more than you, or like you more than me, and may reject one of them based upon what their personal based on their personal feelings about one of us, the argument is, you know, the same. It has to be treated the same no matter what the origin is. I'm going to ask if you're typing on the keyboard or phone or something to just refrain from doing that if you can help it, just because it's coming through the audio. Okay, I don't know. We were hearing something come through.
Oh.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, but yeah, as I was saying, you know, when it comes down to the arguments themselves, you know, it doesn't really matter, you know, what the training of the person is. It doesn't matter what their background is. It doesn't matter what licensure they have or degrees they have. It just matters what the argument is. So you don't attack the person to attack the argument. You attack the argument itself. And I'll attack David Gordon in his and what you're doing now a little bit is you're kind of making that appeal to authority that he's not a real philosopher, as in he's not, you know, part of the in crowd in academia or something, so we can't take him super seriously. Even though I do agree that, like, perhaps some of his arguments, especially in UPB, could have been a lot better, and they're not as thorough as someone like Nozick. But, you know, we have to talk about the actual arguments rather than saying, well, you know, he's not going to be taken seriously by academics. You know, so...
Well, his argument won't be either.
Yeah, but focus on the arguments. Don't talk about, you know, well, he's not taken seriously by academics, and Nozick was, so Nozick's a better philosopher. It doesn't work that way. Just talk about the ideas.
Yeah, well, the actual idea is not even...
I'd like to make a suggestion that we focus on the criticisms that Gordon brought up rather than whether or not Molyneux has any kind of credentials or authority on the matter.
That's a good idea.
Since the argument is what's important.
Yep.
Do you have anything to say about that, Mac?
Sure. Well, I go about critiquing Molyneux a different way for his actual argument. Gordon is very, very nice in his critique. In my opinion, he could have easily done a lot worse because Molyneux's book is a mix of analogies that don't work and like rambling. Like he says that there's a universal ethic out there, but he can't ever prove it in his book. He doesn't ever show how there is, like, how we know that there's morality, how it's universal.
And have you read his book?
Yeah.
And how does he attempt to do this? Because all I've heard you say is you're repeating things in Gordon's article.
He never does, though. He says he's going to, and then he goes through... But then he sidesteps everything
How does he attempt to do this? Can you tell me?
How does he attempt to do it? How does he attempt to prove UPB?
Yes, please tell, and then why you think it's wrong.
In essence, he starts out at the wrong step. Like at the very beginning, he says murder, rape, and theft are wrong, and he says
it's not true.
What's not true?
What you just said.
What that he says murder, rape, and theft are wrong.
Murder, rape. No, I've read the whole first the half the book this morning. There's no mention of murder, rape in the whole first half of the book. You must be going from some webpage or something.
Rape. He mentions rape in the book plenty of times.
The opening part.
That's not the basis of his argument.
Let me find it. It's in Gordon's article.
It says those are good things to run through UPB as a test to see if it agrees with what we would consider either common sense or other commonly accepted theories. I mean, it's simply just a test case. It's a control case.
Yeah, but here's my argument.
You have to run something through to see if it makes sense.
But here's my argument to that. The argument is, everyone around the world has kind of accepted that murder, rape, and theft are wrong. Therefore, if my theory does this, then it proves my theory. But at the same time, everyone around the world has accepted that taxes are okay. Like, we've accepted, as in the majority has accepted that taxes are in fact okay. That's why all geographical worlds around the world have taxes. So are taxes also okay?
He doesn't use that as proof, though.
Exactly.
That's his method of showing that UPB...
That's just a single line. That's just a single line from the book that you're taking out of context because you've only read Gordon's article. You actually haven't read the book.
I have read the book. That's why I critique it so much. And I actually
please tell me something that's not in Gordon's article. Please, because all you've done is parrot Gordon's article.
What is it? Okay, just one thing.
While you look for the reference that you're looking at, I'd like to say that we're actually our audience probably doesn't know what we're talking about. So I'm going to talk about it a little bit. We're talking about a book that Stefan Molyneux wrote a few years ago, which is called Free Domain. The book is called Universally Preferable Behavior. It's available at freedomainradio.com/F. It's basically freebooks.aspx. It's a very long, complicated URL. If you Google it, you will be able to find it and follow the conversation if you'd like to, because it's free. It's in a PDF version, so you can download it from the website and take a look at it. Mac, go ahead.
Hey, I just want to... You claim that I haven't read the book. I actually have read the book. I want to know how many of you have read the book.
I think I've read the book. Toast has read the book. Wrong Opinions read the book. Rotos read the book.
I've read part of the book, but not all of it.
I've read the book, and I read it twice. And the first time, it didn't click with me. And the second time, it sort of did. I still have a few objections about it. But I like the way in which the book will lead you to, you know, anarcho-capitalist or libertarian philosophy without too much fuzz. However, I do have to say it's a really complicated book, and it's really hard to follow. I wouldn't fault anybody for, you know, making a mistake.
It's written simply, but it's got complex ideas. I think that's what my opinion of it would be. Like, it takes a lot of thinking to wrap your head around what's going on there.
It could use a second edition. In my humble opinion, it could use a second edition.
Oh, easily. I think there's a lot. I think, especially the first part of the book, where you mentioned, like, this is the one criticism I do agree with you, Rep Mac, that he does claim that there is a universal ethic out there, and he has his, I guess, five proofs, if I'm not mistaken, in the book that, he's got his five proofs that he goes through, and they usually utilize this sort of argumentation ethics to prove the existence of this universal ethics, this universally preferable behavior that exists that his entire framework applies to. And it doesn't do a great job. I think there's a lot of flaws with it. And if he could, if he really spent an entire book just on that one topic about proving the existence of universally preferable behavior, the rest of the book falls into place pretty well. As you said, the problem you bring up is that, well, he starts from the position of some things are obviously wrong, so this is going to be our test for whether the framework comes out with sensible results. I think it's more so that he goes through the proofs of things like murder, rape, theft, and proves, you know, how those things cannot be consistent with two men in a room. He takes the term two men in a room argument and says, well, two people can't possibly rape each other at the same time. They can't try to have sex with the other person against their will. Like, if, you know, one person, you know, is raping the other person, that means the other person doesn't want to have sex with that person, and therefore they can't rape him back, because that would mean they're okay.
But that's just a logistical problem.
It's an absolute contradiction.
Instead of grandstanding. So please do go ahead.
Yeah, like, that's ahead. Just a little, that's a logistics problem, the fact that it's, you could do some ways to rape each other at the same time, but it's kind of a logistical problem.
How?
But
how would you do it?
Well, like, since the definition of rape is, what is it? They could rape each other orally, both of them. Like some people said, two people can't murder each other at the same time.
But how can they be raping each other? Because the definition of rape...
Tell me if you disagree with this definition.
Tell me if this definition is wrong. Okay. The definition of rape is, you know, the initiation of sexual penetration against the will of the other person. Something like that. So, you know, if I sexually penetrate you against your will, that's rape. How can two people rape each other at the same time?
Well, because then that's...
If one person... This is the way I see it. And this is the way Steph puts it. If one person wants to rape... You know, person A wants to rape person B. He, you know, goes ahead against person B's, you know, desire to have sex with that person. And to have sex with person A. And, you know, person A initiates, you know, sexual penetration with person B. Now, if person B wants to simultaneously rape person A, he has to initiate sexual contact with person A, and person A has to not want to have sex with person B, and person B is being raped, so he doesn't want to initiate, he doesn't want to have sex with person A, but then he has to if he wants to rape him, so it doesn't make sense. Like, there's the logic falls apart.
No, it doesn't. You're assuming person A, the initial raper, doesn't want to be, your want, like, doesn't care about getting raped.
But like, that's the important thing. The person must have an opinion.
But a rapist sexual... doesn't want to get raped.
Right. That's why rape can't be a moral virtue, because if everyone wants to be raped, then it really isn't rape anymore.
See, yeah, that's another problem I have, is mutually exclusivity. Like, it can't be mutually exclusive.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have a question. Would you say that it's reasonable to say that a thief wants his property respected but doesn't want to respect other people's property just as much as a rapist wants his body respected just as much as he doesn't want to respect other people's bodies? Would you say that's fair?
See, that is fair, which makes it possible for two rapists to try and rape each other, or to, in fact, rape each other. Because two thieves can steal from each other, but not want to get stolen from.
So,
see, there, you just changed the word
the
from rape to
itself,
stealing, and
you
have...
Call it, I mean, I didn't mean to change the word. I want to analyze this with you, because I think it's a valid, line of thought. And I don't want to let it, you know, let this line of thought just fall through the cracks. So, if one person rapes you and you rape him simultaneously, how would that work?
Well, it's a logistics problem, but we can just change the word from rape to theft, or stealing. If I steal from you, how can you steal from me at the same time?
Correct.
See, the rape here is very smart, because it's a logistics problem.
Because your example is good, right?
The stealing one?
It is a logistics problem. It is a logistics problem just as much as, you know, having the same rock in two places is also a logistic problem, right?
The same rock, yeah. Well, not the same, but they're both logistics problems. Oh, I found the part where Gordon talks about Molyneux's thing. The rape, murder, and theft. I'll read it. He says,
Would you say it's a logistics problem?
Rape?
I'll bring it up later. Just go ahead.
Okay, yeah. He says,
never mind. Just go ahead, because I'm interested in what you're going to say, but I have a question for you later.
Okay. Yeah. So the thing I was talking about, how Molyneux wants to look through UPB to show that it's real. Although I have so far been critical of Molyneux, I'm happy to give him credit for an excellent idea. He suggests that a good test for moral theory is its ability to arrive at the correct result for obvious cases like rape, murder, and theft. If a theory cannot show the rule that purported to make such conduct obligatory is ill-informed, the theory should be rejected. Molyneux thinks he can show exactly this for his own account or of universally preferable behavior. The question that I have is, well, how do we know that these things are wrong? And if we already know these things, if we have in ourselves, then why do we need universally preferable behavior if we already know these things are, in fact, wrong? Like, how do we not know right from wrong already?
So I'm going to jump in here, actually. This is toasty time, if you didn't recognize my voice. I just think that the whole semantics argument that I guess RetMac, you, and Throwaway were getting into, I just think that's kind of irrelevant to the actual criticisms that can be made of UPB. And I just wanted to put this out there before the show ended, at least. That... I think the reason why these logistics problems, as you say, are becoming such a big problem is that actually Steph's dichotomy, you know, where he gives up his seven categories of, you know, always morally wrong, sometimes, never, no moral content, these things are actually, it's not really a correct dichotomy that when he's taking...
Are you talking about the thing at the end of the book where he has, like, the morally, like, enforceable versus not morally enforceable wrong, but, like...
Out on page 54. He's never really offering up an explanation of why force can be sometimes morally wrong, because I think the definition of universality he uses is that, you know, it covers, like, person, place, and time, when in reality he's later using it to mean context-free completely, meaning that if something is, like, never morally right, then it must be always morally right. And I think that's a big problem that you probably are getting into, instead of these little semantic arguments of, like, can you really both rape both people at once? So, I mean, I think that's probably a better avenue to take. And then you don't have to get into these little semantic arguments that sound kind of bickery, honestly. Because, I mean, I've got a lot of objections to UPB. You know, and not to mention that I think all five of his proofs for the existence of this are completely bogus.
Yeah, but the question I've asked Ollie is, like, what is UPB? Like, I know it's a method to do, like, look through what is moral and not moral, but then how do you decide, like, what's moral, amoral, and immoral? Like, in a given
proof.
Situation, you
I
can
simply,
kind of...
It's just a proof, right?
Well, yeah, but... Well,
it's a framework. UPB itself is a framework that you test moral theory. So you test the idea, like, is murder good, morally good? You know, that's a theory of morality. You run it through the framework of UPB, and UPB tells you basically, you know, is it consistent internally? Is this a valid conjecture?
I disagree with that definition, actually.
Do you?
I think you have to define it as nothing more than a proof. It proves what it proves, and if it fails to do so, it's not a correct proof. And just saying it's a framework to put it through alone, I mean, doesn't really tell you anything.
I'm just using Steph's definition.
I'm disagreeing with his definition then.
Well, I mean, that's fine. His layman definition is UPB is designed so you can test whether moral conjectures are fucking stupid or not. Like that's his actual layman's definition. So I don't know. I mean, I've always thought of it as basically like, does this thing, this conjecture, self-detonate on itself as a universal claim or not?
Right, but my problem is that it's not much of a framework, because all it does is explode the always case. I mean, because what you're saying is rape explodes in the always case, so it's not always universally preferable.
Well,
like,
I'm not sure.
Intuitions tell us that we know this, but he doesn't have the correct framework to dismiss the sometimes or usually not morally moral cases, right?
Mm-hmm. Hey, Rido, can you do a tech check? I'm hearing some strange, like, banging noises coming off on the caller line.
I'm not sure exactly what it is. I do know that the banking noises are coming through my bridge, but my bridge is not actually mic'd up. It's actually recording directly from Skype. Mac, are you typing on the keyboard or something?
No, I'm not doing anything. I'm in a basement, though, and the wall's kind of creaked, so maybe that's it.
That all right, could, okay.
Yeah.
But...
anyway... sorry.
That could be it. If I may interject for a moment, Mac, you had a question about UPB that is basically the definition of UPB, and I think that we're all better served by having as close to possible as layman's terms definitions for everything that we use, right? So when we're talking about UPB, we're talking about a framework that helps us discover or prove or refute moral theories, and we are still, you know, a long ways from being able to define moral theories the way we define scientific theories. Would you, if you don't mind me asking, would you care to define what a scientific theory is and how we can approach it in the realm of the prescriptive rather than the descriptive?
All right. So you want me to just define what the scientific definition of a theory is? Is that, like, what you're asking?
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, okay,
exactly.
So... well, I'll just start out with hypothesis.
Because we're using the same word to describe two different things, right?
Okay,
yes.
So I'll just go with the hypothesis and work my way up. Hypothesis is just, like... well, I think it's good to understand both. The hypothesis is, like, a simple, like... can be a simple test. Like, if I do X, then Y is going to happen in this, like, specific case where, like, I want to see what happens. And the theory... and so, hypothesis is very simple. Theory is very broad and general. So, like, the theory of evolution is, like, the idea that creatures evolved through, there's kind of been a wrench thrown in it with the epigenetics at the moment, but, like, through genetic drift and through mutations and things like that. So it's just a general theory, but it's gained through certain hypotheses come about certain different tests on each of these things that'll cover a very large subject, basically. So there's like the theory of gravity, which, I mean, is too complex. I don't think is fairly really complex. Like, I don't. Yeah, you have to have like a PhD to understand that one. There's theory of evolution.
I mean, I think we got the point at this point. We're running actually out of time on the show mm-hmm. in general. So, if you want to call back and talk about this at a different show, that'd be great. We're gonna
wrap this up
at the time.
Yes, please do, Mac. Would love to have you on the show again.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. It was really nice to talk to you guys. I think I disagree like everything with Molyneux, so I'll probably call again because I don't think it's where libertarians or ANCAP should be going, because I don't think it's good for us or our image, or I don't think it's right. Like EPB, I don't think it's like right because he can't like. I just think it's all a mess. So.
All right,
take care.
Have a good night.
Take care, Mac. And by the way, we don't actually talk about Molyneux in every show, right? But if you want to call next week, it would be awesome
I'll just,
to have
if you
here.
Guys ever mention it and I'm on, I'll call, I guess.
All right, well, have a great night.
All right, you too.
You know, I keep getting confused. I keep really getting confused from the two computers because it's like I'm at work and there's like the two screens and I keep moving the mouse from one computer to the other to try and hang up or to try and minimize a window or to try and just touch this the bridge configuration. And it's impossible because, of course, I'm touching the wrong mouse pad.
Well, you did, man. You did one of those switch boxes.
You did something
right.
I was
gonna get mine for my stuff.
You did something right because it's a lot quieter now.
Anyway, great. Guys, as always, we have attracted polemic and conversation, and it's been awesome. I wish we could have had a little bit more time. We may need to diversify into, something like a debate, decline to state conversations or something. That would be very good. And we have the platform to do it, so why not?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was hitting the keyboard. I don't know about you guys.
No, he was really angrily hitting the keyboard.
Like he was
banging
on it. Uh-oh. I don't think he was angry. I think he was just looking for something on the internet or something, or just looking for references.
He was. You can tell before he would start talking, he was just control-effing the article just to like search for what to talk about. But then, while you were talking, he would just chicken peck really hard, like one key a second. Like,
all right.
It was like obvious he was typing.
Let's not get into this. All right, we should probably just wrap up.
Yeah. I don't think that's... Anyway, we do need to have somebody wrap us up.
So let's go ahead and do it, guys. I think we ended this in kind of a fit of passion, and we'll restarted it, and we're going to end it the same way. So
to be honest, passion is the thing that drives everybody. Isn't it?
Right? That's what I'm saying. So we're going to say that we hope you enjoyed the show. I know a lot of our listeners may be waiting for the archive because tonight we happen to be competing for viewership with Adam Kokess on the Joe Rogan Show. So I think a lot of us are going to check that out, and maybe we'll talk about it next week. As always, remember, if there's a topic you want to hear discussed on the show, please submit to r/declinedestate@reddit.com. You may recognize us by our Reddit usernames. Hell, we may already be best friends or sworn enemies, as you might get the idea. So please be sure to praise us or flame us as appropriate. I'd like to remind you that Decline to State is still brought to you free of charge as well as commercial free. And a big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, and our listeners. Decline to State is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. And remember, when asked, always decline to state.